This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Stewart, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hey, everybody. I'm H.F. Mason. I'm a General Surgeon and Chief Quality Officer for the Baptist System.
And I'm Bill Cloud, Assistant Chief Medical Officer at Baptist Healthcare.
Well, folks, we have a special guest today, and her name is Kimberly Olson. And what we're going to be talking about is driving improvement as a medical staff professional, or what many people know as an MSP. So driving improvement as a medical staff professional. And I really love this conversation because so often we understandably talk about improvement in the clinical settings, but what about those other settings that has to make everything else work? But before we jump right into that, Kimberly, if you would, tell us a little bit about yourself and about your background.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. It's a definite honor. My name is Kim Olson, and I've been working in healthcare since right after I graduated high school, actually since 18, and spent most of my career so far, about half of it, in health information management and healthcare administration. That's where my education and certifications are in health information management and healthcare administration. And I've been in the credentialing medical staff services profession for almost 10 years now. And I'm just so excited to get to share some of my experiences with you and with everyone that's listening.
So, Kim, you mentioned some of the things that you do as a medical staff professional. What exactly is that? What is a medical staff profession?
Yeah, thank you. So medical staff professional is a term that is used for individuals who work in a hospital or surgery center or medical group practice, and they are doing the credentialing and verification, or vetting is what I like to say, for physicians, advanced practice providers, and allied health professionals within an organization. So one component or piece of that is really just gathering all their education, background, training, and then the concept of trust but verify, of course, right? So we are going to the primary source of that information to verify. So for a new physician coming to an organization, for example, we do a detailed analysis of everything that they've done professionally since they graduated medical school. So we will reach out to their medical school. We will reach out to internship, residency, fellowship programs. We verify that they completed those programs, of course. And then we reach out to any hospital that they've had clinical privileges. We reach out to insurance companies that have had them as a member, look at their malpractice history. We do a criminal background report. We contact professional peer references that they provide to us. And we, most importantly, we follow our gut. If something seems a little strange as far as a practitioner's career path, then we ask more questions just because we want to make sure that someone joining an organization is safe and competent and well-educated and trained. And our job is to really just gather those facts and present them to the medical staff leaders at an organization for them to make a determination and recommendation on that file and pass that up to the governing body. And then the other component of medical staff services is provider enrollment. So that is a new piece that our industry has really embraced over the last decade, because honestly, provider enrollment didn't really have a home. In a lot of organizations, it would live in a lot of different places. Maybe it was under the revenue cycle. Maybe it was under the medical staff umbrella. It could be under the operations umbrella. It could be under finance. So really, as an industry, we've really taken on provider enrollment with insurance plans as a key piece of our industry. And so those are the professionals that are getting folks enrolled with insurance plans and networks. And a lot of the things that they're doing really overlap with what a traditional credentialing specialist in a hospital is doing as well. So there's a lot of synergy there.
And Kim, we have a lot of healthcare professionals on this call, but we also have a lot of lay people that listen. And I think that sometimes lay people think, well, you graduate medical school, you finish your residency, you hang out a shingle and then you start practicing. But you know, from what you're saying and from what we have all experienced, it's a rather lengthy and complicated process. I mean, you liken it to, you know, if you're going to work for the FBI or you're going to work for the government, I mean, there's going to be an extensive process that you have to go through. And as you said, an extensive background check.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, recently I was working with a group that was kind of mapping out all of the pieces of data and documentation that we collect. And we had more than 300 unique pieces of data on a provider that we are getting from them or about them or collecting for them. So it's a definitely a pretty involved process.
Well, you've mentioned physicians. What other sorts of people who provide direct care to patients go through this process?
Yeah, so advanced practitioners, advanced practice practitioners, so that can be physician assistants or any type of advanced practice RN. So nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists, CRNAs, nurse midwives, just to name a few. So those are all practitioners that we would credential and privilege, as well as, you know, in some organizations, they are credentialing and privileging licensed clinical social workers or licensed clinical professional counselors, chiropractors, dietitians. You know, it kind of depends on the organization and their billing practices, as well as kind of what the medical staff determines who are the provider types that we are going to credential and privilege in our organization. And then, of course, there are, you know, some guidelines from CMS and other accrediting bodies that kind of dictate those provider types as well.
And is this a one-time thing that these providers go through and then you're done with it?
No. So the initial credentialing process happens, of course, when someone's joining a organization, but then subsequent reappointments is what we call them. Those can occur anywhere from, you know, 1 to 3 years, depending on the guidelines of the organization. That's actually been a pretty big change in our industry over the last decade, is that kind of the standard practice always used to be every 2 years. And then recently, organizations have started to go to every 3 years as state and accrediting bodies allow that. And so that's been something that a lot of organizations have had to kind of determine if they're going to stay with every 2 years or if every 3 years from a reappointment standpoint.
And Kim, we, you know, here at Baptist, we have our Baptist management system. That is the system that we use to approach improvement. And we try to apply a lot of lean principles to all of our processes. And part of that, part of being lean is decreasing variation in processes and also removing waste. And talk to us about your approach and when you look at how people go through their credentialing process, and not necessarily all the nitty-gritty details, but talk to us about all the different variation and waste that you see and some of the strategies and tactics that you use to reduce that variation.
Yeah. So just for me personally, kind of how I got into credentialing, like I said before, I'd worked in health information management for about a decade. And, you know, I was just ready to kind of try something new. So I was very fortunate that the leader I reported to was actually had a background as a Lean Six Sigma black belt. And so really, I had a very strong sense of performance improvement. I went through the yellow belt training. And so I was able to move into a senior business analyst role within our performance excellence department. And that's really where I developed kind of or solidified my passion for data science and how we can use data to really drive improvement in a variety of ways. And one of the projects that I worked on was actually related to C. diff, hospital-acquired C. diff infections. And so really using different data points and working with our physician leaders to think about, you know, the testing protocols that we were using and were we following, you know, the CDC guidelines? Were we doing something different? And so we used a software system at the time called Vizient, where we could gather benchmark data from other organizations. And we were able to drill down to see, okay, out of our admissions, how many patients do we have who are getting an order for C. diff versus what does that look like at a national level? And we were able to determine that we were way kind of over testing patients, and the sensitivity at the test at the time was really picking up kind of any trace C. diff infection versus an active C. diff infection. So
it had a very high sensitivity, but a low specificity. It was.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So that was really, I guess, for me, my first taste at really being able to see the impact that data can have from a quality perspective on patients and how I could participate that as a non-clinician. So related to that, I started working with our medical staff department on their peer review process, on their OPPE, which stands for Ongoing Professional Practice Evaluation. And that's essentially how we evaluate quality at an individual practitioner level, anywhere from every 6 to 8 months. So specialties are setting up kind of those clinical metrics and things that they want to track and trend. And so I started working with that team to kind of look and evaluate their OPPE process, as well as their internal peer review, which is how a medical staff reviews cases, reviews data, and really is looking to how do we continue to advance care? How do we maybe take an outcome that we wouldn't have hoped for? How do we learn from it? How do we make sure that that can't happen again? How do we redesign our process to make it difficult or impossible for that circumstance to happen again? And then I got asked, because I was kind of already working with the medical staff, I got asked to work on a product or a project for delegated credentialing, which I had absolutely no idea what that meant. I kind of knew, you know, at a high level what the medical staff office did, but I really didn't know anything about payer enrollment or the insurance side of things at all. And I just thought, oh, well, that sounds, you know, pretty cool. If we can get providers seeing patients a little quicker, if we can get reimbursement coming in the door a little bit quicker, then yeah, I wanted to be a part of that. And so that's really kind of where my exposure to credentialing came into place. And right away, as we're talking about analyzing processes, it became obvious to me that we had two different groups of people, ironically, even using the same system, but they were completely siloed. So a physician coming to the organization that we were going to bill their services for, they would get an application, a 38-page application that is mandated by our state, from the hospital medical staff side, and they would get the exact same blank application sent to them from the payer enrollment team. And, you know, it's not too difficult to say, well, why wouldn't they be sharing that information? Why would we send it twice? Why wouldn't we just send it once? And so that really kind of evolved into redesigning our whole process and thinking about how do we step back and not think about, you know, what I personally need for this one task that I'm completing, but how do I step back and look at kind of the big picture and put myself in the shoes of a provider that's trying to just do the thing that they've spent, you know, 15 years training for, right? Which is to see and take care of patients. How do I put myself in their shoes and make this very lengthy process as administratively easy as possible? How do I reduce that administrative burden? And so that's kind of where we started. And then we added components along the way. You know, how can we make this more enjoyable for the staff who are doing the work? How can we get rid of those redundant processes? How can we reduce the number of people that are reaching out and having to collect information? How can we work more together so that we're not siloed and asking, you know, for the same pieces of information again. So that's kind of where we started on that process improvement journey, specifically from a credentialing standpoint.
Kim, let me ask you a question about the complexity of all these guidelines. And you've got two different worlds who govern and set the rules that you have to comply with, one on the hospital side, one on the payer side. So talk a little bit about how that works and how that may make your work a little more complicated.
Yeah, so I kind of like putting things into a grid, and we, as an industry, we have an association called NAMSS, N-A-M-S-S, and they do a great job of kind of providing resources to look at all of those different accrediting bodies that were required to comply with. But from a hospital, traditional medical staff standpoint, I'll call it, you know, you're either looking at Joint Commission requirements, CMS, of course, you're looking at DNV or AAAHC, which is an accrediting body for surgery centers. So you're looking at multiple different potential accrediting bodies, and then as well as state specific requirements that they might have that would be coming into play. And then, like you said, on the payer side, you're looking at accrediting bodies such as NCQA or UREC are a couple. And there are a lot of nuances in the process. So just some kind of simple differences would be, on the hospital side, they're more focused on really evaluating clinical competence. So on a hospital standpoint, we're collecting things that we call case logs or clinical activity. So I'm asking the physician to say, okay, in the last 12 months, how many of these procedures have you done? How many total surgeries have you done? Because again, we're trying to evaluate, have you been actively working in the last 12 months? How are you staying competent in the industry and in the role? On the payer standpoint, from their accreditation, you know, they're not getting into that much of the detail in that way. They're looking at making sure, you know, that education, training, competencies are being met. And they have very much more stringent guidelines as far as the time that you can verify certain things before it goes to an approving body. So the hospital side, they don't get that prescriptive in that way. So just as an example, you know, we have to make sure that all the verifications that we do on the payer side are done with, you know, within 120 days, typically is a general guideline for primary source verifications.
What are some of the key learnings that you've had during your whole process and you know, key takeaways in the context of continuous improvement?
Yeah, I think some of the key context or key things that I have learned about the industry overall is, you know, there's still a lot of opportunity. There's significant variation from organization to organization, a lot of different needs. You know, a small private, you know, medical group, they're going to have a lot different needs than a large health system. But there is still a lot of similarities. I think a big thing is also terminology. That is one that continues to be a huge challenge. You know, when you say credentialing, that can mean five different things depending on who you ask. So really, I think an opportunity for us is just to continue to standardize terminology and definitions just within our own industry, and then educating the rest of healthcare about the differences between credentialing and privileging and provider enrollment, because those are really three distinct processes. But even on calls, you know, even on calls this week, someone might say, well, how's their credentialing looking? And you have to ask, you know, clarifying questions. Well, what part of that do you mean? You know, do you mean specifically their file that's going through the medical staff committees, or do you mean how they're looking from, you know, payer insurance approvals coming in?
Yeah, we found that just this week, you know, when you talk about allied health professionals, some people think that's inclusive of APPs or nurse practitioners, and sometimes we just don't have have clear definitions. And so we're not speaking the same language.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then I think just, you know, again, there's a lot of opportunity for evaluating workflows. You know, I feel like 20 years ago, you know, in the medical staff office world, there was this mantra that really was the burden of proof is on the provider. And I can remember that phrase, you know, coming from, you know, an MSP. And, you know, while that's true, it is true that the burden of proof is on the provider. There's so much that we can do to, again, just assist them and walk them through that process so that, you know, we get what we need in a timely manner and they get what they need in a timely manner and just really working together and supporting one another and educating one another about the process. So I think that's a huge opportunity too, is, you know, make sure that when you're sending those introductory emails to your providers, kind of lay out the timeline, give them a brief overview of what those milestones are in the process and what are the dates and the goals that you're hoping to achieve in that process, kind of setting that expectation for them and for yourself on the front end. That has been really, really helpful and successful in organizations that I've been a part of. Because again, you know, you could be working with a physician that this is the first time they've gone through an initial credentialing process in 20 years. Maybe they were working at one organization for 20 years and they don't remember having to do all of these things. They've not updated their CV in 20 years. So just really being supportive. And again, you know, putting yourself in the shoes of the provider, I think is just a key opportunity that, medical staff professionals are really embracing. And I think that's really exciting. And then,
go ahead.
Lastly, I was just going to say, you know, continuing to optimize, you know, your software systems that you're using. You know, that's one more thing. The number of MSPs that I hear that are still relying on an Excel spreadsheet or very manual processes and paper documents is still surprising to me in 2025. So really making that investment in software, and then I think how you can grow and integrate AI, you know, is your software vendor, is that something that they're actively investing in? Because they should be, right? There's so much opportunity with AI to kind of reduce the, you know, high volume manual tasks, you know, like going out and getting a screenshot of a license verification off of a website. There's just a lot of high volume things that have to be done that I think AI is going to really help automate. And then the cool thing about that is it will position the MSP to really be able to focus on the critical thinking aspects of a file and, you know, being able to have the time to really bring those things up to medical staff leaders' attention. So I'm really excited about the future as well.
So Kim, I think I can speak for Dr. Mason and myself to say that the subject of credentialing did not come up during the process of your medical education, either in medical school or residency.
Not at all.
And the bottom line result of this is to be able to see a patient in the hospital or take care of patients in the hospital, you have to go through this process. On the payer side, to either see patients of that insurance company, or even if you see them, to be able to bill for them requires you go through this process. So my question is, what on the national scale, from your organizational standpoint, what are they doing along those lines to collaborate with medical schools and residencies to give learning physicians some insight into what's coming?
Yeah, well, I don't want to speak on behalf of NAMS, although I do know that partnering with groups like the AMA is something that that they are doing. I think the opportunity for our industry is just to really, you know, provide education. So for me personally, what that's looked like, it's reaching out to my local, you know, residency program and saying, hey, can I come present to your third year residents and give them an introduction to this topic and basically give them the how can you help me help you, right? How can you come in and be a file and a professional who's going through the credentialing process, and you look like a rock star as a new resident? I want to set them up to succeed by really educating them on how do you organize your documents? What do you actually need to save? Something that comes up a lot is, really providers should be saving a copy of their certificate of insurance, which is typically an annual renewal. You should be saving all of those. You should be asking for copies of all of those and saving that in your own portfolio so that in the future, if you do make, a change or you're going to get privileges at a new hospital or institution, you have all of that information readily available. Keeping your CV up to date, keeping contacts for your residency program, your internship programs. And then I think finally, making sure that the peer references that you list are kind of actively still engaged with you in a clinical capacity. It's not uncommon that we will have someone list a peer reference and it's someone from residency that they haven't worked with in 20 years, which really we want relevant, who can attest to your skills and clinical competence in the last 24 months. So making sure that your peer references are current and that you kind of give them a heads up that you're planning to list them as a reference so that they can, be prepared to speak to those things.
Kim, I have to admit that I wasn't even aware that there was such a title as an MSP, a medical staff professional. And I looked real quick at NAMS and that there are certifications that you can get. And I guess my question is, do people just kind of fall into this role, or are there people who start out their careers saying, I want to be a medical staff professional? Tell us a little bit about that. I'd be interested.
Yeah, in my experience, I think most people do fall into it. That has been my experience for sure. There's not necessarily like an educational pathway. Like there is with health information management, I had to attend a certified baccalaureate program in order to even qualify to, sit for my RHIA certification. So it's not like that with NAMS. It really is kind of on the job experience. So you have to have at least 3 years working as an MSP in order to even be eligible to sit for that certification exam. And kind of on that note, so currently they have two certifications, what they call the CPCS, which is the Certified Professional Credentialing Specialist, and then the CPMSM, which is more of your leader management certification. And in 2025, there actually is going to be the first nationally recognized certification for the provider enrollment skill set. So that is coming in 2025. I had the privilege to be able to volunteer in the development of that certification. And I'm just so excited because it's an area that's really been so needed. To have a way to, really set a standard for what a provider enrollment specialist should know, what are those key competencies, and then having a robust exam to, be able to prove what it is that you know is pretty exciting.
Kim, what do you know about any requests that NCQA might be directing towards CMS to be able to accredit hospitals like Joint Commission?
I am not really aware of NCQA's plan as it relates to being an additional hospital certifying body, but that would not surprise me, because they do have a lot of accreditations that they offer, patient-centered medical home, certifications for utilization management and review. So, yeah, I'm not read up yet on kind of what their plan and timeline is with CMS, but. It would not surprise me.
Well, Kim, I know that you and Dr. Cloud and Kim Colbert and all the credentialing team, y'all have done a lot of great work already to streamline the process and to decrease that that time. And I know y'all have been working with Dave Gutcher doing 8-step problem solving, but it's just really refreshing because as Skip mentioned at the first of the podcast, most of the time when we're thinking about our improvement work, we're thinking about it in the context of the clinical setting. How do we improve patient outcomes? But this work is just as important in all the support departments that are non-clinical. And I really appreciate you guys, working with us here at Baptist to help us get better.
Kim, I really appreciate you sharing how you got to this domain and this space. And your enthusiasm and passion for improvement work. I know that our organization has identified this as probably our number one opportunity for improvement. It's a nice domain to be in right now, I think, from an improvement standpoint.
Yeah, it's honestly exciting, you know, because you know, being able to redesign a process and kind of giving so much trust to redesign that. And the team is just so eager to really look at that big picture and work together. So it's been a joy for sure.
Well, Kimberly, you know, or Kim, you know, it's been great, great. I love getting to know you. I love some of the many meetings that we've had. I just love this improvement mindset in a non-traditional area, but wow, is it needed. You know, I always say that healthcare is the most complicated socio-technical system on planet Earth, and this is a great example. You can have the greatest physician in the world, but if they're not credentialed, then they're not going to be able to do much. And so
they're not working.
That's right, they're not working. But on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, Kim, thank you so much. Hopefully you'll be willing to come back again to the podcast. But we are so grateful for you and the great work you and the team are doing, and just really enjoyed spending time. Thank you so much, Kim.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And I'd love to come back and get to share all the team, what they've accomplished in the future. So thank you so much.